thinks you're out at the old ball game.
Welcome to Let's Get To, the baseball podcast from the fan's perspective. Now here's your host, James Christopher.
And welcome back to Let's Get To. I am your host, James Christopher, and we've got a great show for you today. First, it's a Let's Get To first time, an actual professional ball player, Brendan McGuigan, a part of the Seattle Mariners system, is here. We're going to talk to the Inland Empire 66ers, and we're going to be looking at the Hawaiian Islanders and our Raiders of the Lost Diamond segment. But I want to talk a little bit about some of the best ways to consume baseball. You know, baseball gets a bad rap because people think it's boring on TV or whatever. And, you know, I can watch just about anybody play a game of baseball. I find it relaxing. And my favorite way to consume it is on the radio. And I was thinking about this driving home, trying to figure out kind of what I wanted to talk about in today's episode. And Dominic Contronio got to call one of the Astros spring training games. And Dominic works for the Corpus Christi Hooks. He does a lot of stuff. As you've learned, if you listen to this show, if you work for a minor league team, you do a lot of stuff. But it got me thinking about his dad. So his dad, Vince Contronio, was part of the Astros broadcast team when I was a young lad, when I was a tyke, when I was a kid, when I was growing up. And thinking about him, right? And thinking about that connection. And then we're going to talk a little bit about Todd Callis's dad in our Raiders of the Lost Diamond segment. So the whole thing kind of just got me thinking. Baseball on the radio. Baseball on the radio for me will be, most importantly, two guys. It's Gene Elston and Milo Hamilton. And I'll be honest, if I have to be able to tell you who was Gene and who was Milo from like games of like the 80s and early 90s, I couldn't tell you because it ran together because I was a kid. But those were really the voices of my childhood. And then I was driving around all weekend listening to Craig Way call the Longhorns. And it just, baseball on the radio, there's really nothing like it. I think baseball has this ability because of the nature of the game, because there is beats between action. And because, yes, it's a team sport, but it's a team sport comprised of individual battles, that the voices bring so much to it. We spoke when we discussed Brockmeyer on last week's episode how they're so important that, generally speaking, the play-by-play guy in every baseball movie is depicted, be it something, you know, traditional and serious like in Bull Durham, or Bob Uecker's famous portrayal in Major League, which led to him becoming the Brewers guy. But baseball on the radio, it requires someone to be able to paint a picture, to be able to describe to you what is obviously happening from a nuts and bolts perspective, while weaving the story of that game, i.e. how a player is done, how the game is sort of developed from inning to inning and pitch to pitch and at-bat to at-bat, while also weaving in where the story connects to baseball as a whole, to a whole game. And it's something that baseball does better than any other sport. When we hear about a player coming up and however many home runs or RBIs or whatever, we also will talk about what players did 50 years ago and 60 years ago and 100 years ago. And it's up to the play-by-play voice to weave in and out and to be able to paint all of those different pictures at one time. And then in the case of a minor league announcer, of which we've had several on this show, of which we have Steve Wendt, the broadcaster for the Inland Empire 66ers, on this episode today, not only are they doing all of those things, telling the nuts and bolts of the game, how the narrative of that game is coming together, and how that narrative fits in its place in baseball history, but also delivering on the promise of what's to come for the parent club. It's an incredibly difficult job, and the best do it with an artistry and with a familiarity that you get to know as if they were your friends, them and the team they're covering. You know, so much about this show, it's about baseball and its focus, it's the 100% on the cultural part of it. You know, even when we're talking about nuts and bolts and what's going on in spring training and all of that fun stuff, The focus is really on where the game fits in our culture. And in talking about Dominic Cotroneo, who, by the way, did a fantastic job today for the Astros, listening to him do all the things I talked about and make exciting a spring training game just with his tone of voice. And he didn't oversell it. I mean, it was just the kind of thing where he would be chatting with Robert Ford, who was doing color. Robert is the normal Astros play-by-play voice. And then just go right into something crazy that happened, had me fired up. And I understand that it's a spring training game and all I care about is learning about Justin Verlander's injury. But it really helped drive home just how important the voice of your baseball team is. But all of that is kind of set within the backdrop of it being International Women's Day on Sunday. And there and the Lexington Legends hosted a meeting of some of the women that are doing that job at the minor league level. Some of them we've had on the show, like Melanie Newman and Maura Sheridan and Emma Tiedemann, who we're also going to have again. But I just want to congratulate these women for doing a fantastic job. First of all, you know, I've listened to Melanie call a game. I've listened to Emma call a game. I actually taught one of Emma's calls in my baseball and culture cinema class this past January. But for being just outstanding representation for what the game means to people. And look, I am a 44. I'm going to be 44 on Monday. It's not a therapy session for me. I'm a 44-year-old white guy. I don't know what it's like to have a roadblock put in front of me because of my gender, because of my race. I know that I am married to the strongest woman that I've ever met, the best person that I've ever met, someone that I look up to every day and I want to be just a little bit more like. She would probably say that I'm a little slower in the getting to be a little bit more like her, but I'm working on it. I'm a work in progress. I'm the father of a daughter that just amazes me every day, that is an incredible mother, that is teaching her son the game of baseball, a game that she loves just as much as I do. But I don't know what it's like to be either of them or any of the number of students, Bella Marco, who my film student, the best I've ever had, who is at UT Film, who came to visit me today. Like, I don't know what it's like to have all of those, to have people, the society, members of the world, look at them and say, hey, you're not going to be able to do this as well as somebody else simply because of gender or race or orientation. All I can do is do my best to listen and be compassionate. I'm just proud of the Lexington Legends for putting that event on. But I'm even more proud of the women on that panel that talked about what that experience is. And I wanted to have gotten to know Melanie and Emma and Maura even just a little bit. They are impressive people that I think are going to go as far as their spirit and their will takes them. They are amazing examples. And in a world that reminds us every day that it kind of sucks, there are a lot of reasons why I think that there is hope, not just for the world, but for our game and for, I think, the direction that they are pushing and the inspiration that they are giving to young women across the country. Melanie had tweeted, when she tweeted a photo of the members of the panel, that firsts are great, but it's more important that we aren't the last. And I hope that you're not the last. And I hope that the women that follow you realize how special it was to have had you five as trailblazers. So for what it's worth, this 44-year-old white guy is super impressed by all of you. And I can't wait to follow the rest of your careers. So stick with us for what will be a fun and packed episode.
Raiders of the Lost Diamond. A look into baseball's past.
And welcome to this edition of Raiders of the Lost Diamond. You know, it's almost spring break time here. I start my spring break next week, but everybody's thinking about traveling. And now for a lot of people, spring break travel means you go down to places like Key West or South Padre Island and you just drink and do stupid things. I'm not single or in my 20s, so I am going to head to spring training and watch a little baseball. Hopefully I'll be able to make that trip and there's not the case of, well, the coronavirus, honestly. And for a lot of people that are thinking about traveling, my favorite place on this big blue marble is Hawaii. And Hawaii has a long and rich baseball history. The Hawaii Islanders were a minor league baseball team based in Honolulu that played in AAA Pacific Coast League from 1961 to 87. They were originally an affiliate of the Kansas City Athletics, and the Islanders played all their home games at Honolulu Stadium, Aloha Stadium, and then Les Murakami Stadium. After being one of the more successful minor league teams, the Islanders eventually faltered and moved. The Islanders were originally an amateur team, but on December 17, 1960, the Sacramento Salons, a longtime PCL team, moved to Honolulu. Now, at the time, minor league baseball was in freefall. Sparse attendance, Major League TV was getting big, expansion and franchise shifts at the Major League level, it all caused a lot of minor league baseball teams to contract and collapse. So the Islanders came to Hawaii in part due to these trends. The Solons had been suffering from attendance problems since the arrival of the San Francisco Giants from New York City in 1958. By the end of the 60s, the Islanders were one of the strongest franchises in the minors. In 1970, the Islanders won 98 games and drew over 400,000 fans to lead all of minor league baseball. That 1970 team was named one of the 38 greatest teams in minor league baseball by minor league baseball historians. Due to the Islanders being a distant 2,500 miles from their nearest opponent, they utilized a unique schedule. Initially, PCL teams made a 4-7 game visit to the islands, with the Islanders then doing the same. Later, as the league expanded, the Islanders played 8-game series against each team in order to cut down on travel costs. The travel costs also applied to radio coverage. In the early 1960s, due to the cost of line charges, Islanders radio announcers used the old method of recreating the road games in a Honolulu radio studio. Think about how they did the road games in Bull Durham. Same thing. This method was used by most major league teams during the 30s and 40s. Despite the remote location, the Islanders were home to some of the more iconic broadcasters in sports. Harry Callis, who had just gotten out of the military, was the play-by-play voice, and he would later move to be the iconic play-by-play voice for both the Houston Astros and Philadelphia Phillies. He was then replaced by Hank Greenwald, who would later be a broadcaster for the Giants. Even Mr. I Believe in Miracles himself, Al Michaels, was a play-by-play announcer for the Hawaii Islanders. In the early 1970s, the Islanders were the closest thing to an independent team in the high minor league baseball. While standard minor league deals meant that the parent club controlled all of the rosters, the deal the Islanders had with the San Diego Padres at the time typically called for the Padres to send about 6 or 7 players to Hawaii. The Islanders would then sign players on their own to fill most of those roster spots, and that made them free to trade them, sell them, or release them without approval from the Padres. This worked very well for the Islanders as they won consecutive PCL titles in 75 and 1976. The Islanders achieved success and stability as the Padres' top affiliate from 71 to 82, but spent most of the second half of the 80s in short-term affiliations with both the Pirates and the Chicago White Sox. The beginning of the end came when the Islanders moved from Honolulu Stadium to Aloha Stadium in 1976. It had been obvious for anyone that saw the team that Honolulu Stadium needed to be replaced. It was an old wooden stadium that was referred to by many as Termite Palace. It had reached the end of its useful life by the mid-60s. However, the new multi-purpose stadium was located on the other side of Oahu from Honolulu, making it difficult for the main body of the team's fan base to get to ball games. Due to the new stadium, they nearly lost the 1976 pennant. The new Aloha Stadium had artificial turf. And as you may not know, but you don't generally wear cleats or spikes on artificial turf. You'll use rubber cleats, something made specifically for that surface. The Tacoma Twins, however, were ordered by the parent club that they always would wear metal spikes. And so, right out of the movie Bull Durham, the stadium management killed the center field lights, preventing game to be played as long as the Twins were wearing the metal cleats. After 35 minutes, the umpires forfeited the game to the Twins. Then due to the forfeit, the Islanders entered the final series of the season a game and a half up on Tacoma in the Western Division. The Twins then promptly won 3 straight over Spokane, while Hawaii lost 2 at home to Sacramento. So Tacoma was now a game up. The results were then reversed on the final day of the regular season, and now the two teams were tied with 76 wins apiece. Hawaii then prevailed in a one-game playoff in Tacoma to win the division crown and would go on to win the PCL in 1976. However, lowering attendance and poor performance led to the downfall of the Islanders, who left the islands in 1988. The Islanders won the PCL in 1975 and 76 and won their division seven times in their history. And their notable alums include Barry Bonds, Bobby Valentine, and his alter ego, the one with the nose mask, and the great Tony Gwynn.
Who's on first? The Let's Get To Team of the Week.
And we're excited to welcome the Let's Get To. Our team of the week this week is the Inland Empire 66ers, and we're joined by Steve Wendt, the Director of Broadcasting. Steve, how's it going, man?
It's going great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I got to be honest, I've been a fan of you guys from afar. I think I own your Copa hat, and your Christmas hat is like one of my favorite things ever. So I'm actually a little tickled to have you guys on this week.
That means a lot. I know the hats are a big deal. You're a connoisseur.
I am definitely a connoisseur. So before we jump into that, though, how did you end up, you know, getting interested in baseball, end up being the broadcaster for the ball club?
The long and short of it is, I'd always had a passion for baseball, and eventually, injuries and not being that good kind of coincided right about when I was in my college years. So I played JUCO baseball, and then I transferred to UC Santa Barbara, where I was lucky enough to get involved in the school newspaper and the school radio station. And I'd always, you know, as much as I wanted to be a baseball player, I think just equally I'd wanted to talk about the game. And so I was given that opportunity there. And then from there, I sent out tapes, old cassette tapes. That's how old I am. And got a job in indie ball and with the Sonoma County Crushers of the defunct Western Baseball League. And bounced around and eventually came back to California with the 66ers. This is my seventh season with the team.
One of the things that I love the most about baseball is baseball on the radio. It's funny. I was driving home from a shoot in Houston to Austin and was listening to Longhorns commit five errors, but this is not a therapy session. So, growing up, I'm an Astros fan. So like Milo Hamilton, those guys, those were the voices of my childhood. What about you? Some of the voices that kind of influenced you to get into this?
Yeah, 100%. I was super lucky. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and you're really spoiled. My hero, I'm sitting in my office right now, and I have a picture of him in my office, as a matter of fact, and I didn't know him personally, but I felt like I did, and that was Bill King. Bill King, if you didn't live in the Bay Area, maybe you didn't, you know, he's not a household name, but you know, at one point he did the A's, the Warriors, and the Raiders at the same time.
Wow.
He was a legend. He was a legend, absolute legend. And so Bill King was one. Lon Simmons was another. And for my formative years, those two were paired up. Lon Simmons is kind of known as being with the Giants, but the Giants kind of screwed up. And the A's snatched him up for a number of years and partnered them together. And it was amazing. They're both, you know, Cooperstown. Hank Greenwald was another great one with the Giants. And at night, even though I was in Northern California, I could get Vin Scully. I think Bakersfield must have had a flamethrower of a station, so at night I could get the Dodger games. So I was really lucky listening to all those guys.
Yeah, no kidding. And it is funny to me how, and I don't know how it is. I'm older too. I'm in my 40s, so I don't know how it is for generations now. Like the Astros have a good crew, and anywhere I listen to a lot of the minor league guys since we do this show. But I don't know if it has the same impact as it did when we were kids. Of that really is like you said, the voice of your childhood.
Yeah, I hope so. I really hope so. You know, I mean, yeah, you know, I was, you know, under the covers and had the AM radio, you know, and you know what? Maybe these kids have some sort of electronic device, but hopefully, you know, the medium may change, but hopefully the message stays the same. I hope that never goes away. Just listening to the game and kind of almost imagining it in your own mind, what you're hearing.
Yeah, I think it's the best way to do it. So, you know, when you're calling a game and you get to big moments, I mean, do you get, professionally, I'm a filmmaker. And so everything that I do drama wise is structured. As a broadcaster, I know you can start to read the tea leaves of what's going to happen, but do you kind of get in your own head about how you want to make sure a call comes to life? Or do you just sort of let the moment do what the moment's going to do?
I try to just let the moment do what the moment does. I think that if you're prepared, then those things can happen organically, and you know, you've done your work, you're knowledgeable, and then you just have to rely on, I mean, I hate to use the term, but talent a little bit. I mean, it's a, you know, a talent to be able to describe something.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that's where I hope, you know, people ask me, what's your home run call? And I say, home runs are like snowflakes. Everyone's different. I don't have a canned home run call. You know, some people do, and that's great. And if they can weave that in, that's fantastic. Good for them. I really don't necessarily have one specific call that I lean on or anything like that. I just try to call what I see. But for me, you know, the tension builds. You're human. You sense when things are happening. So I think just naturally you're building to a crescendo, and fortunately in baseball, that crescendo will happen a lot, and you get to really celebrate it.
And in a lot of different ways. That's what I like most about the sport. The final out of a no hitter or a walk off home run, all dramatic, all equally different though.
Super dramatic. You're right. For me, it's not even always the end of the game. A brilliant defensive play, you know, that in the outfield, a ball hit deep to the gap. Is someone going to get to it? You know, there's two guys converging. Who comes up with it? And sometimes when you're in the minor leagues, the lights aren't so great, so you have to delay that story then to see if they actually did catch it. But, you know, a play like that, or if you're just, you know, if you're in a story and all of a sudden there's a rocket hit to the backhand of the third baseman, and you have to quickly change gears from storytelling to an explosive moment. That's fun. And I enjoy that. I enjoy listening to that. And I enjoy that sometimes I get to do it.
I do think that is what I like the most about the sport though, is how you really can go from a stop to the most exciting thing you've ever seen in a matter of seconds. And you've got this comparative of these moments to breathe and these time between games between action to really ruminate on the game. And then all of a sudden, like you said, a dive up the middle that you didn't see coming happens. I think it really is what makes baseball stand out to other sports.
I agree. You know, I do basketball and I love it, and I get to do it for my alma mater at UC Santa Barbara, and that's fun. It keeps me connected. But there I feel like I'm more just a verbal stenographer. I am just straight up describing what's happening. Whereas with baseball, I have to weave in, I have to balance that storytelling with the game action and make it pertinent. Whereas basketball's, you know, so much action that, you know, it kind of takes care of itself. Not to say that it doesn't take skills, but it, you know, the action is constantly happening in front of you, and you can kind of fall back on that.
Well, and let's go to the 66ers. So you guys are the high A affiliate of the Angels. And I want to say that I actually made it out to two Angels games this past year when the Astros came in at the end of the season. And I was super impressed with the Big A, particularly as old as that stadium was. I thought it was a great place to watch a ball game.
Yeah, they're doing a nice job over the years. I remember the first time I went there was, oh boy, more than 20 years ago. And it definitely still felt like a multi-purpose, you know, just kind of, all right, well, there's a baseball game in here tonight. that is gone. And even in the past probably 3 or 4 years, they've improved the, you know, the options for food and the areas, the gathering areas and things like that. So it's really cool. I think they've done a great job. I don't work in that building, so I don't know what pipes leak and things like that, but they've done a great job of doing, presenting it. And I think, you know, being down the block from Disneyland, you get a really good lesson here in Southern California on how presentation matters, you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So for you guys, for the home slate, you kick off on April 17th. Visalia is coming to town. What are some things we can look forward to promotion-wise or just ballpark experience-wise from the 66ers this year?
Well, that opening night, we'll have fireworks. Yeah. Fireworks are always fun, but, you know, we'll do anything we can. The bobblehead slate is always super fun, and this year we have some great ones. We'll get to that, but, you know, we have our Kukuis. You mentioned the COPA, the Minor League Baseball Initiative, and we've been lucky to be part of that with the Los Kukuis. And if you're unfamiliar, Los Kukui is, or El Kukui is the kind of the equivalent of the boogeyman, it's been explained to me and a lot of our fans, people know that the cucuy is a big part of when you're growing up in a lot of households in Southern California and in Mexico and in other places that, you know, if you don't, you know, clean your plate or clean your room, the cucuy is going to get you. So we kind of played on that, and it's been very successful. So we'll have a half dozen of those nights where we take part in that Copa de Diversión. It's a neat initiative, and I think in Southern California, we've always done a good job reaching out to our Hispanic and Latino fans, but I think having a special night is pretty cool for that. But you know, those bobbleheads are always a big night, and we're going to have a bunch of those, and even some ones that are maybe less well known, but in our area, we think they will be. Obviously, Joe Adell, we're going to do a Joe Adell, and he's Angels' top prospect. But we have a cool one later in the year for one of our coaches, Steven Hernandez. He's our first base coach. He's a legend in Southern California, this region, the Inland Empire. He'd been a longtime high school coach and a scout for the Angels. And, you know, he's battled some injuries, and he, you know, he's in his 60s, but he still gets out there to first base every game. And it's like he's running for office. He's shaking hands all the time and people love him. So we're going to get him a bobblehead this year. So that's going to be a very cool one. You know, we're lucky. We're so close to the Angels that, you know, the fans come out. We're going to have a Justin Upton night, but we're also going to have a David Fletcher and night, and then we have some Angels giveaways, like a Hawaiian shirt with the Angels logo on it. So we're lucky that the big league affiliate's so close to us that we can kind of dovetail with those things.
I noticed that you guys do some stuff for like first responders and military, which I think I'm surprised more teams don't do that. I mean, what kind of reaction do you usually get for those?
Pretty good. Basically, you know, we feel like it's our duty as kind of a tentpole in the community to celebrate those that take care of us. And so with our first responders, you know, on Sundays, we honor all military and first responders who serve the community. They get half off their seat purchase if they bring an ID. And just, you know, it's not necessarily that we're out there waving the flag and trying to, I hate to put it so bluntly, but like cash in on patriotism,
right.
But it's just simply a fact of we want to show some appreciation. We want to acknowledge that there are those that serve us and we can help them too.
Well, I think this sounds great, Steve. This has been a blast. I feel like you and I could probably talk baseball for hours. Thank you so much for being on Let's Get Two. We cannot wait to shine a big light on the Inland Empire Ball Club for you.
Well, we appreciate it, and I appreciate that you shine it on us and all the other teams in minor league baseball. It's a great thing, and enjoy the season.
On deck, the Let's Get Two interview of the week, brought to you by Fine Line Sportswear.
So we're excited to welcome to the On Deck segment of Let's Get Two, Brendan McGuigan. He is a pitcher in the Seattle Mariners system. Brendan, how's it going today, man?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Hey, thanks for being on the show. You have the distinction of being the first actual professional ball player we've had on.
So I'm honored. Thank you for having me.
I think that will get you something. I don't know.
Hopefully.
I'll get you a t-shirt. How about that?
Perfect.
So I got to ask, man, and this is, I think, always fascinating, is how did you get into baseball in the first place? Like, what drew you to the game?
Honestly, I've had a baseball in my hand ever since I can remember. Growing up, I was probably 3 or 4 first time I started actually playing. I mean, my memories go back to just kind of tossing the ball with my dad in the yard. Got into T-ball at a young age, probably 4 or 5 years old. As long as I can remember, I've played baseball. It's just always been my go-to.
So you graduated high school in 2014.
Yes, sir.
Do I have that correct?
Yes.
Our producers are doing their job.
Yes.
which means you graduated in Austin, Texas. Did you feel the pressure of football? Like, I mean, you graduated, you would have remembered Vince Young and all of that stuff.
Definitely. Yeah, I played some football growing up as well. To be honest, I was a very late bloomer. So I was getting my teeth knocked in football.
Okay.
I was pretty small. So I got out of that sophomore year of high school. Stuck to baseball from then on, but I did dabble in football. Wasn't great. I was a little undersized.
So while you were you here with Mitch Morris? Did y'all overlap at all?
No, we didn't.
You did not. Okay, cool. I don't know why I like to ask that question because again, I think people forget that we play baseball down here because of the cultural identity that is football.
Yeah. And the baseball field kind of tucked in the back. You don't see it unless you drive into the back of campus kind of, but,
yeah,
no, I mean, I love going to school here, and baseball tradition here is very rich. Yeah, I was very lucky to play some ball here for sure.
So after school, you end up playing for the Richmond Spiders.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so playing college ball, a little bit of a give us a little bit of a glimpse into the life of the collegiate baseball athlete.
I mean, it's busy. It's busy for sure. Being at a mid-major, it wasn't as glamorous as a lot of the places like University of Texas, where they've got all these multi-million dollar stadiums and facilities. But I loved it. I loved it there. It was a pretty small school, great academically. It was a beautiful campus, absolutely gorgeous. And I met some of the greatest people I will ever meet in my life there. I'm very lucky. I was there for 5 years, but all the teammates I had, every team I was on there was just, it was just a great group of guys every year.
What made you pick Richmond? I mean, was part of it getting out of, like, I mean, I went to UT. I think that's awesome. But I also understand if I grew up in Austin, I didn't grow up in Austin, so I might not want to stick around. Was there the idea of getting away for a little bit? And
honestly, like all through high school, I always thought I wanted to stay close to home. So it kind of took me by surprise that I ended up going there. But to be honest, it was my only D1 offer. I was, like I said, I was a very late bloomer. So I was definitely under recruited a bit, kind of under the radar guy. So I had an offer to D3 school, Southwestern University, which is about 20 minutes from here. And then it was Richmond. And those were the two. Okay. So I committed to fall my senior year, which I guess if I had held out, could have had a couple other options. But I mean, Richmond was such a good opportunity. I couldn't pass it up. So I was very, very happy to commit when I did.
And a cool name. I mean, the Spiders.
Oh, yeah. It's unique. It's funny walking around and people were like, Richmond. Oh, that's Spiders, right? I'm like, yeah. It's just like everyone kind of knows it sticks out. So,
yeah. So what would you say, I guess, like, you know, you talked about being a late bloomer already twice and we're 5 minutes in. So what would you say to people like, you know, like I, it's so weird. So I, a buddy I played high school baseball with 25 years ago, sent me a photo and I was all ears and didn't know how to wear a ball cap yet. I never bloomed, but what would you say? Like, cause like, I feel like we're in this age now where you start grooming your kid at like 5 or 6. And if they're not playing the right select team, what would you say to kids who haven't bloomed yet? I mean, as far as like whether they should keep pushing or not.
Honestly, the biggest thing is just stay the course and don't lose hope. I mean, my freshman and sophomore year of high school, especially freshman year, I was more of a middle infielder who kind of pitched, and like, I loved pitching, but definitely loved hitting and was someone who was trying to make it as a hitter and a fielder. But, kind of started growing a little bit my sophomore year, really sprouted up between my sophomore and junior year. And before I knew it, I was a pitcher who also kind of played third. And senior year, I was pretty much just a pitcher. I did play third when I didn't pitch, but right. I mean, it was also a rude awakening for me. I realized once people started throwing good breaking balls, I just couldn't hit them. So I narrowed my focus easily. But I mean, I hit that growth spurt and I started throwing a lot harder and it just kind of came out of nowhere. So it opened up a lot of options I didn't expect as a pitcher.
So, you know, we've done a little bit of research on this show, and the one kind of area that I haven't visited yet that I'll be actually heading out this year is this collegiate summer league thing.
Oh yeah.
So can you explain to people, because so going in, the only experience I had with that was the Freddie Prinze Jr. movie Summer Catch. And if you haven't seen it, check it out.
Oh no, I know it.
Jessica Biel is the truth in that movie. Sorry.
That's in Cape Cod, right?
Yeah, Cape Cod. Yeah. It's, you know, we had those guys on we had the owner of that team and they do not like that movie.
It was Chatham, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So my roommate in college actually played in Chatham for 2 years.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm definitely familiar with that movie. But so for those who don't know, college summer ball is huge. There's honestly probably, I might be exaggerating, but almost like 100 leagues. It feels like there's so many different leagues, and it's all pretty much all wood bat leagues all over the country. It's a huge thing. People from all over kind of flock to different areas. There's obviously Cape Cod up in Massachusetts, is the biggest one, or I guess most prestigious,
most famous one. But,
I mean, the Northwoods Coastal Plains, California has a league that's really, really good as well. There's like a league in Alaska. I mean, you can go anywhere really. So that was
cool. We have one here, but I don't think it's very big. Like I think
there's a small Central Texas one. It's smaller. I played. Well, I guess there's two. There's a bigger Texas league with like the Brazos Valley Bombers, a big team in that. But then there's like a very, very small Central Texas team, like a league around Austin. I played in that after my senior year of high school, actually.
Okay. So where did you end up playing when you were in college? Where did you end up playing and why did you pick them?
I played in the Northwoods League up in Wisconsin. So I was in Lakeshore.
Okay.
The Lakeshore Chinooks was the team. Shout out Nook Nation.
Yeah.
I loved it there. It was awesome. Summer ball is a very cool opportunity to experience a new part of the country for sure. I would never have gone to the state of Wisconsin if it wasn't for summer ball, I feel like. So I stayed with the same, I was actually there for 3 years, stayed with the same host family all 3 years. And
still in touch with
amazing.
Them all that
yeah, stuff. They're yeah. amazing. They're awesome. The Taylors, they're fantastic people. Shout out to the Taylors.
Okay.
John and Linda, they're awesome. They took care of me for sure. They're great. It was a great experience. Got to meet so many people. And then all of a sudden you're friends with all these guys from different teams throughout the country. And all of a sudden the next year you're playing against them and you're hanging out. So it's really cool. Makes the baseball world a lot smaller as you go.
Yeah. I'm going up to cover the Madison Mallards.
Okay. Yep.
This year. So
yeah, we played Madison every year. They're in our division. Madison's a cool spot. That stadium's pretty nuts.
Great. Yeah. I hear the stadium's great.
Yeah. It's nuts. They get like 6,000 fans a night, something crazy like that.
So then you're a free agent?
Yeah, so I went undrafted, yeah.
So before I ask you about where you signed and all that stuff, growing up, what was your favorite major league team?
I'm a Toronto Blue Jays fan, or I should say.
First of all, shout out to my best friend, Mike Donis.
Okay.
And in the description of this, I'm going to post a photo because makes films with me, comes down on Canada Day. I'm in a Blue Jays hat with him.
Awesome.
So shout out to Mike.
Love that.
So you grew up, how did that happen?
I'm Canadian. I'm a dual citizen.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it narrowed the field for sure. Being Canadian, being like, all right, there's a team in Canada. So my dad's from Toronto. All my family's up there.
Sure. Okay. I'm going to be up there this year for the first
time.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. Toronto's a great city. I love it up there.
I'm going to go watch the Astros at Blue Jays this year.
Okay. So that'll be a good one.
I was hoping you'd say the Rangers because I always jokingly end the interview at that point. You know, wraps us up for today.
Not a Rangers fan.
Especially not if you're a Blue Jays fan.
Yeah, definitely had some fun when I was in school watching the Blue Jays Rangers series. That was a lot of fun for me.
So then you get signed by the Mariners. Now, obviously, yes. You are part of the Mariners. Shout out to my other best friend, Matt Dudley, who's a longtime fan of the
Rangers.
There you go. Of the Mariners, excuse me. Knowing that when you make it to the show, you're going to play your hometown team. That's got to be, or I guess the team you grew up being a fan of. You think it's going to be weird? Like, or do you, at that point, by the time you work through the system, does it matter?
I definitely think it'd be cool. I think it would be really, really fun, especially because if I'm lucky enough to make it up to the big leagues and can travel to Toronto with the Mariners and play in that stadium, it'd be awesome to have all my family there.
Heard about Abraham Toro last year.
Yes. That was a really cool story.
Yeah, it was a really cool story. It's not a lot of great stories about that team lately, but
yeah.
that was a good one. But story note, when we refer to Abraham Toro, we're referring to Astros player and Canadian native Abraham Toro, who, while playing his first series as a professional ball player in his home country, hit a 2-run home run in the ninth to preserve Justin Verlander's no-hitter. Want to thank you to producer Jessica Bybee, my lovely wife, who reminded me that people might not know what I'm talking about. Back to the interview. So you end up in West Virginia. So tell me a little bit about playing for the West Virginia Power. And by the way, good numbers for, I think you went through 11 innings, have about a 1.5 ERA.
Something like that. I don't even know. Yeah, I don't even know how many innings I threw. I was there pretty much the last month-ish, a little less than a month of the season. I was a super late free agent sign. Went undrafted. Kind of knew I was... Had a shot, long shot to be a late day three draft guy, but kind of knew my spot was going to be as a free agent sign.
Okay.
Thought it was going to happen earlier than it did. Thought it was going to happen 2-3 weeks after the draft.
So do you try out for teams or do you just hope everybody knows who you are and you just wait? I mean, how does that work?
Well, throughout the year, you're filling out questionnaires and talking to different scouts and things like that. So, you know, you're on guys' radar and they come see you throughout the spring. So after the draft, kind of a little bit of communication with some teams, trying to figure out if they had spots, roster availability. Nothing ended up coming together, and July hit, and I was sitting at home. I've been training and throwing bullpens and things like that, and I just kind of hit the point where I can't just sit here anymore. I got to make something happen. I can't just twiddle my thumbs and like hope something falls in my lap. That's just not who I am. So I had to go kind of take action a little bit. Ended up contacting the people back at Lakeshore, where I'd been the past two summers, and they had a spot for me within like 2 days. So I just went up there, was there about a month, and was very lucky. I got placed in the showcase game.
Oh, good.
For the Northwoods League in August, beginning of August. I think it was August 5th or 6th, something like that. And pitched in that, pitched really well, and a Mariner scout was there and was waiting for me outside the dugout after the game. Talked to him then, and it was just kind of crazy. I'd never filled anything out for the Mariners throughout the year. They were not a team I was in contact with. They're very much out of the blue in that sense, and ended up going home, I think, 2 days later. They flew me out to Arizona, signed within the week.
Wow.
Yeah, and then...
just like the movie Summer Catch.
It was crazy, yeah. It was crazy. I was bouncing all over the place. I flew out, I think it was a Sunday night. I flew to Arizona. Monday morning, had a bunch of appointments, physicals, things like that, just running all the tests, making sure I was all in one piece. And then it was probably 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I actually put pen to paper and officially signed. By 3 o'clock, they said, here are your flights. You're going to West Virginia. I was on the red eye that night.
Yeah.
So I was just bouncing all over from Austin to Phoenix.
Through the next day. You're like,
yeah. Oh. And I met the team on the road in West Virginia. They were in Delmarva, and, I met them on the road. I was very lucky. I had a friend who was already on the team. So he kind of showed me the ropes, helped me out a little bit, introduced me to the guys.
What were your thoughts playing in West Virginia?
It's definitely an adjustment. It was all like, I guess, in a sense, overwhelming, but also comfortable playing baseball. Baseball is like my safe place in that sense.
Sure.
So it was one of those things where everything was overwhelming going to Arizona, thinking I was going to be in the Arizona League rookie ball for the last 3 weeks, then go home. And then I get there and 5 hours later, they're like, oh, just kidding. Here's your flights. You're going. Just kind of being all over the place, not really having a sense of like what was for sure going to happen. Was a bit overwhelming, but then once I was able to get out on the field, it was just same baseball. I mean, you're still playing the same game, whether you're 10 years old or 24, 25, it's the same game. So you get on the mound, you still got to throw it to the catcher, same stuff. So that definitely helped. First outing started off strong, then kind of ran out of steam, struggled a bit, but kind of settled in after that. And yeah, I mean, it was fun. We had a lot of good guys on that team as well. As definitely experience. It was nice to kind of just get that first pro ball experience out of the way, and definitely excited for spring training here.
So before we get to spring training, I'm supposed to ask you what your pitch mix is. That's apparently what a baseball journalist does.
Okay. So I'm a little different because if you asked me this 6 months ago, or I guess more than 6 months ago, but a year ago, if you asked me, I would have had a completely different answer because I started for the most part in college. So sure. I was a guy who was fastball, slider, curveball, really bad changeup that I'd show every once in a while. But it was actually funny. After my second outing of pro ball in West Virginia, our pitching coach called me in and just kind of showed me some analytic data and stuff, saying, like, looking at my release height, basically showed me that with my fastball, my curveball, my release angle and height were the same. And it was good. I was able to disguise it the same. But on my slider, I dropped my arm about 6 inches. So I was kind of dropping my arm slot to come around the side of it to try to spin it. He just looked at me. He's like, never throw that again. And I was, yes, sir. So I'm a fastball, curveball guy.
Okay.
That's it.
And now primarily out of the bullpen.
Yeah. And I've been, yeah, exactly. I've been moved to a reliever and not starter anymore. So kind of playing with trying to develop a better changeup so it doesn't suck, but that's a work in progress.
So by the time we drop this episode, you will have already been in spring training out in Arizona. So what are your goals there? It's your first spring training. I mean, I'm guessing you want to get placed. Like, I guess the way it works, right, is that depending how you do, you might end up in AA or AAA or a different – you might not be back with West Virginia is my point.
Right. I think to be honest, I don't know what to expect at all in terms of placement. But if I had to guess, I think there's probably a good chance I end up back in West Virginia. But obviously, my mentality going in is I want to pitch my way into a higher level. So obviously worked very hard this offseason, and feel very ready to go. I'm very excited. So the goal is definitely to pitch my way into High A Modesto if possible and just kind of see where it goes from there.
The Modesto Nuts. All right.
Yeah.
And I guess one last thing about minor league lifestyle. I just imagine it's six dudes living in an apartment eating peanut butter. Is that?
Pretty accurate. I was lucky that someone was leaving. I wasn't lucky that they got hurt, but someone had gotten hurt and left kind of right when I came. That was whose spot I was taking. So The team put me up in a hotel my first four nights there. And then after that, it was like, you got to figure out your where you're going to live. So I was able to just take his spot in a house he was in with five other guys. And it worked out well.
All right. Well, can we have you back on at the end of the season and see how it went?
For sure.
Absolutely. Well, Brendan, thanks so much for being on Let's Get To.
Of course. Thank you.
This just in. News from Minor League Baseball.
So for our news of the week, it isn't news that I often sing Toto's Africa while washing my hands after going to the bathroom. In fact, anytime you hear me singing Toto's Africa, that should be sort of taken as a matter of course and a thing I do anyway. But I've started singing the song while I wash my hands between that and Defying Gravity because those are the choruses of some of the songs that apparently take 20 seconds. Therefore, you're washing your hands for the proper amount of time because of the coronavirus. The coronavirus, it exists in this weird thing where even I don't know what is real and what is not, what is parody, what is truth, what is people filtering it through whatever news media they want to tell it through. I do want to just encourage everyone to make sure that you're washing your hands, that you're taking care of yourself, that you are staying healthy, being situationally aware. So the news comes as Major League Baseball has released a little bit of information about how they're reacting to coronavirus. You know, baseball at spring training time in particular is a very communal game. People sign balls, people get to meet players, and it's sort of been a team by team reaction where some teams maybe aren't taking balls from fans or using their own pens. And Major League Baseball, I guess like everything else, has been slow to respond, but it looks like they have announced a couple of things. One, they are closing their clubhouses to reporters and that they are encouraging that a 6-foot distance be kept between reporters and players. And that I'm assuming most press availabilities will come straight from a press conference format as opposed to the press scrum. Look, it sucks for the reporters. It sucks for the team. It sucks for the fans, but it seems like a logical conclusion as the situation seems to be getting worse before it gets better. They have said as of now that they do plan to finish up their Major League Baseball spring slate, and they do plan on starting the season on time. Major League Baseball plans to monitor the towns that the games are played in and then make decisions about whether or not games should be played, maybe having games played without a crowd. One option said that teams might even play games in different locations outside of the normal metropolitan area if there is a concentrated outbreak. So ultimately, just stay educated, learn as much as you can, try to find the right sources and try to sift through all the rumor and the paranoia and just try to find answers and just do common sense things to stay safe. Wash your hands. Sing Defying Gravity. Sing Toto's Africa like I do. But for God's sakes, whatever you do, quit hoarding the toilet paper.
And now on to close it out, the right-hander from Houston, Texas, James Christopher.
So that wraps us up for this episode of Let's Get To. We want to thank really quick Grace Usselman, who was a former student of mine. Not really a student, just somebody that I got to know. She was in the music department at St. Michael's. One of the most impressive young people that I've ever met. She is as nice and as gracious as she is talented. And that is her doing the intro version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game this time. And that is how we finish every show with her instrumental version of her on the ukulele. She is going to be in the music business. She is studying it right now in Nashville. So we just want to send a really special thank you to Grace for providing that and for being really an inspiration to me, even though you are much younger than I am. Again, rarely have I met someone so impressive. And being studying in Nashville right now at Belmont, we do want to let you know that all everybody from Let's Get To sends their thoughts and prayers to all the victims of the tornado. We hope that you will rebuild, and we hope that things keep going, and that I hope that the Nashville Sounds, when they get kicked off, bring a little bit of solace and a little bit of normalcy to what has to be a crazy time. You know, as we survived the hurricane down here in Houston in 2017 for the Astros, part of the reason why that season means so much is because of what that team meant to that city during that disaster. So our thoughts and prayers go out to Nashville. So he'll be back with us next time. We're going to be talking a little Cubs baseball with Sean Patrick Leonard. Andy Tom Cheston will be here with Go Go Astros. Scott McIntyre with the Big League Chew segment. And Cam Doherty went to Dodger spring training in Arizona. So we're going to get a firsthand report of that. So until next time, let's get to it.